FOMO stands for fear of missing out, and Patrick McGuinness did not invent the feeling, but he did give it a name back in 2004 when he was a student at Harvard Business School. The venture capitalist, podcaster, and entrepreneur says he felt compelled to take advantage of every opportunity at Harvard, and he paid the price for it. What's worse, he says, is FOMO's sister, FOBO. That's fear of better options. He describes how too many choices dilute strong leadership and make us indecisive and regretful in his new book. It's called Fear of Missing Out: Practical Decision Making in a World of Overwhelming Choice. And Patrick McGuinness joins me now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. Do you remember the first time you felt that anxiety that things were going on without you?
Oh yeah, I remember it well. It was my first year of business school, and I was living at Harvard Business School. This was before there was social media. So, you know, the social media that gives us all FOMO today, we didn't even have that. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg was across the river from me, about a mile away, working on the first version of Facebook, believe it or not. But I didn't need that. I didn't need that because I was with 900 other classmates who were all hyper competitive, super social, outgoing people, and we had all these opportunities, and I just wanted to do everything. I wanted to do it all the time. And so I just woke up one day and I thought to myself, I'm doing all these fun things, but I'm not enjoying them because I feel so stressed out that I might miss one of them.
How much of that fear was born out of the times you were living in? I mean, it was just a few years after 9/11.
It's exactly because of 9/11. So I was living in New York City in Lower Manhattan on 9/11, about a mile from where the attacks were. And when I saw that, you know, I was just out of college, and that was right after we'd had an economic correction with the NASDAQ blowing up. And I started to question everything that I thought I knew about the world and the stability that I thought existed in the world. And I thought to myself, I just want to live every day like it's my last. And that was what brought me to try to do everything. So it was very connected to my experience in 9/11, for sure.
And FOMO has become a great punchline, and it's usually quite a playful or humorous context in which it's used. But in fact, there is a real seriousness to it. How did the anxiety impact you then and now?
Well, it's funny because when I wrote the article about FOMO, that was the first time it was ever used anywhere. And so that's why people found me later on and said, you know, you're the inventor of FOMO. When I wrote that article, it was actually in the humor section of the school newspaper at our business school. And it was kind of a satire of this culture of FOMO. But of course, there is a real price to pay. And in fact, as we've gone forward, a lot of clinical psychologists have done a lot of work on this. And I've obviously spent a lot of time in it as well. And we realize now that it has true implications for our mental health in terms of how we feel about ourselves and others, has a tremendous drain on our productivity, and it also has financial implications. People overspend because of FOMO, so it can really hit you in the wallet as well.
I wonder if one of the impacts of coronavirus is that it might help to kill FOMO. I mean, at the moment, most of us don't really have the fear of missing out. I mean, we all really are missing out because we're all at home and nothing's on.
So, Jesse, that was what I thought was going to happen. I remember the first couple weeks of quarantine here in New York City. I closed my door and I started reading books that I've wanted to read for the last 5 years. And I watched every series that I've not watched that I had on my list. And I started cooking. I don't cook. I have cooked. I mean, today I made like cauliflower stew. I don't even know where I came up with these things. So in a way, it's sort of like, yes, it did overcome the FOMO. But I saw this tweet when quarantine was beginning about how Shakespeare had written King Lear in quarantine. And I thought, well, I'm going to do great things. And I had big ideas. And the problem is that the thing that causes our FOMO, which is our devices and social media, didn't go away with the quarantine. In fact, we spend more times on screens than we ever have before. And so we have moved our FOMO. After a couple of weeks of a break, we have moved it online. I have a very exciting Zoom social life, as many other people do. And I found actually that I'm not achieving all of those things. And so I'm now taking the time to recalibrate, and I invite everybody else to do this and say, what were your goals? How did you really want to spend that time? And in the time you have left, how can you best use it?
As you point out, when you first coined that term in 2004, social media was in its infancy. So we can't really blame seeing other people's lives on Instagram for this feeling, can we?
Well, it's something that's been part of the human experience since the dawn of time. And in fact, the earliest humans were well aware of what they needed but didn't have in order to survive, right? That was part of the survival of the fittest. However, what has happened is, you know, this emotion, which has always been part of our lives to compare ourselves with others, has been made so much easier because of social media and the internet. You can now compare yourself. Like, well, I went to your Instagram. You have an incredible life. And I was like, man, Jesse, like, so much cooler than me. I felt a little FOMO, yeah. Right? You live in New Zealand. It's true. It's very good stuff. But I thought to my, you know, that's what happens is no matter where we are in the world, we can compare ourselves to people we either know or don't know and feel these feelings. And so it has gone from being something that's experienced by a bunch of kids on a business school campus in Boston to being something that all of us can relate to.
Thanks for the compliment, by the way. I'll keep that one. but I'll make sure to stalk your Instagram afterwards. You say actually that it's okay, a little bit of FOMO. It's a bit like drinking wine. It's okay in moderation. You know, how can a bit of occasional FOMO be useful?
Yeah, it can be good for you. And this is how it works. I think about it like drinking wine because you say you go to a wedding and you have a glass or two of wine. Maybe you go down that dance floor and you unwind a little bit. You try something new. And that way, it can be good. Of course, if you have too much wine, you might be rude to somebody or get sick and look bad. And so you don't want to feel bad the next day. Same with FOMO. A little FOMO can actually inform us about the things we wish we were doing. Maybe you see somebody starting a company and you say, oh, I really wish I could do that. Or they take a vacation and you think, I'd really like to go there. Then you can explore that FOMO in a sort of a rational fashion and say, is this real? Do I want to do this or not? Or is this simply, you know, rose-colored glasses? The problem is when we have FOMO making major life decisions and actually sort of affecting the way we think about everything in our lives, it's very damaging. So use it to discover new interests and opportunities, but make sure that you investigate them and don't let it take over your life.
Is it something of a threat as we ease lockdown restrictions in New Zealand? Is FOMO the thing that might put us back at risk?
It certainly is a risk. And we've seen in the United States, as we started our quarantine, there are some very highly publicized cases of people who still went to their spring break because they wanted to have that one last party. Huh. Or the people who won't socially distance. And there's a lot of quarantine shaming happening. If you hear somebody's been at a party, you know, everybody's mad at them. And I think the reason is that we all right now need to be respectful of each other and recognize that we each have a role in making sure that this doesn't come back. And so everybody who's listening here, don't let your FOMO get in the way of your good judgment, because at the end of the day, we have to remember that we're part of society and that if we can control our FOMO for just a little bit longer, we'll all be a lot better off.
I'm speaking with Patrick McGinnis, who is the author of the book Fear of Missing Out, Practical Decision-Making in a World of Overwhelming Choice. He's the man who coined the term FOMO. And you also in the book, Patrick, talk about FOMO's sister, FOBO, or fear of a better option, which you describe, I love this, you describe as treating your life like a Tinder feed, swiping with reckless abandon without committing to any potential options. Can you flesh out FOBO for us a bit?
Absolutely. And while FOMO was like drinking wine, FOBO is like smoking a cigarette. Bad for you, bad for everybody around you. Because it feels good in the moment, but that's it. And so the thing about FOBO is it's sort of like hitting the snooze button over and over again when you're making a decision. So say you're trying to decide where you're going on Friday night, or you're trying to make a decision in your business, and you have plenty of totally acceptable options in front of you. But rather than choosing one of them, you're worried that there might be something a little better that might come along. And so as a result, you wait and you delay and you maximize and you optimize and you keep swiping, as it were. And in doing so, you never actually make a decision. And this is bad for you, because you have perfectly acceptable options on the table, but it's also bad for the people around you who are waiting for you to make a decision. And those people, they're not going to wait forever, and it's very frustrating for them.
Is there a biological element to wanting as many choices as possible?
Most definitely. And this is part of our DNA, because we as human beings are sort of pre-wired to maximize, because life is competitive, and succeeding historically has required people to be stronger and faster and better and healthier. So it is something that is part of our biology. But the problem is in the old days when these things were actually pretty useful to us, you were deciding about things like, you know, am I going to sleep out on the ground or am I going to find a source of shelter? Today, the choices that we face, many of them are things like, well, there's 7,000 movies on Netflix or, right? Or there's, if you go on Amazon, you'll find that there are 1,000 different options for white shoelaces. And so it's, if you're spending 5 minutes worrying about two pieces of string that cost less than your latte in the morning, is that a good use of your time? Of course not.
Options are good though, right? Options and choice drive commerce and innovation. So is the problem too much choice, or is our fear the problem?
It is absolutely the fear. I agree with you. I'm a capitalist like many people, and I love having options, and I'm thankful for them. And I'm thankful for the fact that, unlike my grandparents, for example, that I can live in all these different cities and I can buy these different things, and I have the potential to have a much more diversified, interesting, varied life. But that also brings complications, because when we have many choices, we also have the obligation to decide. And if we don't choose, then all of this is sort of for naught, because if you aren't actually making decisions and choosing things, then what's the point of having all of the choices?
David Brooks, as you point out, he's a columnist in the US, calls this the golden age of bailing.
Yeah. And you think about it, I mean, it goes back to you think about how easy it is for people to sort of change their plans. And this is, as I was writing the book, by the way, I obviously base this on a lot of research and my own research, but I also just thought about my own life living in New York City. And, you know, every country is a little different, but I'm sure you have the same phenomena in New Zealand, which is that people make plans, lots of plans. And then when it's time to actually go do those things, it's like, oh, you know what? I just want to go home. And they bail, because it's easy to just send somebody a text message or, you know, shoot them a quick email. You don't have to really, there's no cost to changing plans these days. We've created this culture around it. So I think that is, you know, unfortunately, what that does is it makes our relationships transactional. We don't invest in our friendships, and it's bad. It undermines our society.
COVID-19, by the way, is pulling into sharp focus the inequities of hourly wage workers who have no choice but to go to work, and white collar workers who can. Is it useful to think about choice as a privilege?
Most definitely. And I love that you've framed it that way, because in the book, at the very end of the book, I talk about an experience that I had when I visited some Syrian refugee camps in eastern Lebanon, and how it was one of the first places in a long time where I thought to myself, there is no FOBO here. Because these people are stuck. They're waiting to go back to a country that's in the middle of a war. They can't cross the border. They can't get jobs legally in Lebanon. And so they're in this weird limbo. And while there was plenty of FOMO, because people were thinking about the lives they could have been leading, there was no FOBO, because they did not have options. And you don't have to go to Syria to find that. You can find that in your own community, in the way that you've just expressed, or with people who are ill or infirm or marginalized. And so one of the things about FOBO that's so important for those of us who do have options is to be grateful for them, to feel the gratitude. And when we're grateful for what we have, we will value it more, and we will hopefully take the effort to make smart decisions and to actually choose something.
You are a venture capitalist, and you must need a little bit of FOBO. A little bit of the fear of the better option in order to not miss out on, you know, finding the next big thing.
Most definitely. In fact, I call venture capital the game of foes, because the companies want to generate FOMO and the VCs have FOBO. They always want a little more data, a little more track record, a little bit more performance before they make an investment, because that, you know, the more evidence you have, right, of the trajectory of a company, the better chance your investment succeeds and you lessen the risk. And so that is a dance that is done over and over again. And I think it's important to have criteria. But what VCs PCs do that's really bad and which I really sort of avoid at all costs, and I try not to do this. So if I've done this to some company, they should call me up and tell me, is I'm very honest. I say to a company, you know, I don't just sort of string them along asking for more info without the intention to actually invest. If I'm asking for more info, it's because I will use it to make a decision. I will respect your time and I will tell you yes or no on an agreed timeline.
Have you come up with an acronym, Patrick, for when you have both FOMO and FOBO?
Most definitely. And the acronym, which I also came up with back when I came up with these two, was FODA. And that stands for fear of doing anything. And the fun thing about that is in Brazilian Portuguese, it's the F word. And which is kind of a perfect sort of application. And then if you've heard of the series Fauda, which is from, you know, Israel and the Palestinian territories, Fauda sounds like Foda and that means chaos. So I think it kind of works in a bunch of languages.
Can you discipline yourself to be more decisive?
Most definitely. Like any learned skill, obviously we have natural instincts around decision making, but this is something just like learning a language or learning a sport or learning a subject in school that we can study. We can look at our behavioral patterns. We can improve upon our sort of actions and we can become better at this. And that's why oftentimes you see that people who are more experienced in life, older people, for example, they're much more decisive because they've been practicing all their lives. They have wisdom.
You suggest something called Ask the Watch. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. So this is something that I've actually been doing for more than 20 years. I picked it up in college and it's one of those things that it liberated me from the tyranny of indecision when it comes to small things. So there are small decisions in our lives, what I call no stakes decisions. And those are things like, am I having the chicken or the fish, or am I going for a run or not going for a run today? And I have the tendency to spend a lot of time worrying about those types of decisions, which is bad because it kept me away from doing things that matter to me. And it also distracted me from, you know, dealing with the big things in life. It was a form of procrastination. And so let's, for example, say I'm choosing between whether I'm going to go for a run or not, a socially distanced run. So I basically assign the left side of my watch as yes, the right side is no. I look down and see where the second hand is, and then the decision is made for me. I've outsourced it to the universe. You can do that with your cell phone, maybe even time or odd time. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. It's sort of like flipping a coin, and the value of it is this. This is a small decision. It doesn't matter. You won't even remember making this decision in a day or two. Therefore, either option is fine. The problem here is not the options. It is that you are injecting drama into the decision-making process. So you've got to take yourself out of that process.
Would you recommend it for dating?
I would not recommend it for dating. There, I would say you should get, and this is a low stakes. I mean, when it's early on, if you're going to marry somebody, that's high stakes. But for a low stakes, I actually engage third parties. I ask advice from a friend. So which restaurant should we go to? Which hotel should I stay at? Should I go out with her again? I'm not sure. I engage a friend or two and I get them to make the decision for me.
Okay, great. Because how do you work out which decisions deserve more energy than others?
The way I think about it is low stakes things are things that I probably won't remember making a decision in a week or two. And they are things that don't have major financial implications or life implications at this point. No stakes are things that I won't remember in a day or two that are reversible and have no financial or life implications. And the high stakes ones are the things that do have medium to long term importance. And they're the things that deserve our time and attention and a real focus on us in terms of making decisions.
I just want to conclude by asking you if you think perhaps a little simple gratitude might help curb our FOMO and our FOBO.
Most definitely. If we have the opportunity to make decisions in our lives when many others don't, other people don't have those options and they have due to war or famine or poverty, their scope of options is limited. We should remember that and be thankful for what we can choose. And then to celebrate our ability to choose and the options that we have, we should be decisive and act upon them. Because one thing that we should always remember is that decisions are opportunities to move forward in life and then face a new set of decisions. And if we don't make decisions, we can never move forward.
The book is called Fear of Missing Out, Practical Decision Making in a World of Overwhelming Choice. And I've really enjoyed chatting to you, Patrick McGinnis. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much, Jesse.